Welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. When we last heard, Seneca had just arrived in Rome. He'd been transported there from his birth city of Cordoba in modern-day Spain in the arms of his aunt. Seneca was still a child, possibly little more than an infant, and the likelihood was that he was being sent to the great city at the centre of the world to join his father, known to history as Seneca the Elder, in order to come under that man's direct tutelage and guidance. A clue in one of Seneca's surviving works about witnessing the daily routine of the great Asinius Pollio informs us that Seneca must have been in Rome by AD 5, the year of that multi-skilled man's death. So what would Rome have looked like at that time? The Emperor Augustus, whose elevation to what we now call Emperor of Rome, had taken place in 27 BC, and he was still firmly in political control. This was the first flush of the Pax Romana, or Roman peace. Much of the Mediterranean world and beyond lay under Rome's yoke. By AD 5, Rome's vassal states included everything on mainland Europe, south of the Danube and west of the Rhine. As for the rest of Germania, well, that was still an active work in progress, and it would only ever meet with limited and short-lived success. In the Near East, the territories east of the Euphrates River and south of the Caucasus Mountains had been subdued. In Africa, the Romans had control of everything north of the Sahara. The estimates vary, but the empire, as it stood around AD 5, held somewhere between 40 to 50 million souls, and around 1 million of them lived in or immediately around the city of Rome itself. If estimates for the whole of Italy for the period around Seneca's arrival in Rome are accurate, almost one in two of the inhabitants of the city at that time were slaves. For its time, the city was enormous. Augustus famously crowed, "I found Rome a city of bricks and left it a city of marble." And that was no idle boast. Scores of existing temples were restored, and new ones were built on a colossal scale. Public buildings and public spaces sprang up, fora or marketplaces, theatres, even libraries. And the infrastructure was improved and enlarged. Roads, bridges, aqueducts. It was a massive undertaking, designed as much to showcase Rome's power and wealth as the eminence of the great man, Augustus himself. Seneca must have found himself in a city teeming with people. Alongside the native Romans were incomers from all over the Italian peninsula. There were, in addition, among other races, Iberians, Gauls, Germans, Dacians, Thracians, Syrians, Armenians, Palestinians, Egyptians, Mauritanians, and especially there were Greeks. These were not just from the Greek mainland, but came from the Greek-speaking areas of Italy that had been brought under Roman control over the previous few centuries, or they were from Greek settlements all around the Mediterranean Rim that had been gradually absorbed into the Roman machine. Of the non-Italic races, some were slaves and some were freedmen. Others were simply itinerant workers who, just like today, had come to the big city to find work. Rome was bursting at its seams. Multi-story apartment blocks called insulae sprang up to accommodate the burgeoning population. Many of them were hastily and poorly cobbled together by what we would today call slum landlords. Death by fire, smoke inhalation, or building collapse was an everyday hazard. Favela-style shanty towns lapped against the city walls, and disease must have been rife. Although Seneca later commented at length on the filth, the squalor, and the sheer now biting unpredictability of living in a city in which your home could go up in flames or come crashing down around your head at any moment, his would have been an altogether different experience in Rome. We already know that Seneca's family were of the knightly class, and that Seneca's father was a well-read man, a regular at the rhetor's halls, a man who was excellently connected with the higher echelons of Roman society. Seneca himself tells us nothing about his childhood home in Rome, but it would have been a relatively spacious abode in one of the less crowded areas of the city, well serviced by a team of slaves. And so Seneca's education began. He was probably taught the rudiments of grammar by an educated slave, and he would also have been versed in the Greek language. Greek was still the lingua franca of the eastern Mediterranean and the mother tongue of all Grecian states and colonies, including cities on the Italian peninsula that had started life as Greek settlements. Although the Romans had completed the annexation of the Greek homeland by 146 BC, they still acknowledged the achievements of Greek art and literature, and, in the Rome of the 1st century AD, the language still held immense snob value. Roman education was geared from the outset towards a life in public office. It was a man's world, and girls really got a look in, although that did not stop some women from educating themselves. Seneca's mother, Helvia, for instance, seems to have enjoyed dabbling in philosophy, and her husband, the elder Seneca, although by all accounts a Roman of the old school, did not disapprove. After his initial instruction, Seneca was sent to a grammaticus, where his education began in earnest. Under the stern hand of the grammaticus, boys like Seneca were subjected to the praelectio or enarratio. In this horror-inducing exercise, at least to the ears of young boys, a text would be provided with attendant commentary, which the boys would have to analyse for grammatical analysis, rare or poetical vocabulary, mythological or factual information, and moral interpretation. It got worse. In order to analyse a text, which was sometimes Latin, sometimes Greek, the boys had to both read it out aloud to the rest of the class and commit large chunks of it to memory. There was a lot of moralising involved in this exercise. The pupils were trained to take episodes from canonical texts like Homer's Iliad and Odyssey or Virgil's Aeneid and apply them to contemporary moral situations. Although Seneca would later mock his years under a grammaticus as a waste of time, he was obviously doing so tongue-in-cheek, as using excerpts from the canonical texts to reinforce moral lessons was a technique that peppered his own works. At around 12 years of age, Seneca was sent to one or more rhetors. He would study in this environment for between 3 to 4 years. All Roman education was geared towards a career in public office, and for this, the skills taught under a rhetor were absolutely indispensable. The rhetors themselves frequently gave public declamations. In those pre-electronic media days, no TV, no smartphones, no radio, entertainment options were limited. Declamations by known rhetors could attract huge crowds from all walks of life, and it would appear, from comments made by contemporary authors, that the audiences were very knowledgeable and their ears were well attuned to recognise the skill, or lack of it, necessary to pull off a good delivery. Rhetoric was, therefore, a path to public recognition and acclamation. In Seneca's Rome, just as now, if you were a clever and effective speaker, you had a fast track to political success. By Seneca's era, the majority of learning material under the rhetor was in Latin, although some Greek canonical texts were probably still also used. The study of rhetoric, which is essentially the art of oral persuasion, was traditionally subdivided into 5 categories, namely invention, arrangement, style, delivery, and, very importantly, memory. At these schools, teenaged boys were trained to evolve arguments from probability. They had to use techniques such as paradox, striking aphorisms, and dramatic characterization. In the last stage of rhetorical education, which was declamation, pupils were instructed in the art of the suasoria. In this exercise, the pupil would have to advise, in inverted commas, a famous historical figure at a crucial point in their deeds. An example might be Alexander the Great, who, having defeated every army thrown against him, was considering setting out onto an unknown ocean to find new lands to conquer. The boys would have to put arguments for and against the advisability of doing so. There was also the controversia, which was the debate or forensic address, in which the pupil would have to deliver a courtroom speech either for or against an imaginary and or unlikely scenario. Seneca's father, the elder Seneca, famously wrote books on suasoriae and controversiae, in which he critiqued the delivery skills of various top orators of the time. The controversiae that pupils were given to prepare speeches on often involved quite bizarre scenarios. One such is the case of the prostitute priestess, in which a virgin was captured by pirates and sold. She was bought by a pimp and turned into a prostitute. When men came to her, she asked for alms, that is, a handout of food or money. When she failed to get alms from a soldier who came to her, he struggled with her, tried to use force, and she killed him. She was accused, acquitted, and sent back to her family, and now she is seeking a priesthood. Having been given this scenario, the boys, and we must remember that they were still teenagers at the time, were sent off to prepare their speech either for or against the priesthood being conferred upon the woman. After what we would consider a short period of preparation, the boys had to deliver their speech, but, and this is the important point, without the aid of material prompts. I'll come back to the art of memory in a moment, but will just point out that the cast of characters in the case of the prostitute priestess is by no means uncommon. The various scenarios used for controversiae seem to have drawn on a stock of standard prototypes, such as prostitutes, pirates, and priestesses, and the cast would also often include stereotypes, such as the poison-wielding wicked stepmother, the evil and conniving heir or heiress, and other almost larger-than-life caricatures, whose purpose would seem, in my opinion, to be to highlight the more extreme ends to which humans are prepared to go in their interaction with one another. These very identifiable personality types also, I would suggest, serve another function, which is as a kind of memory hook for young minds. It's easier when committing arguments to memory for future presentation to associate them with a mental picture, and this is exactly what the exaggeration of a caricature provides. And this takes me rather neatly onto the topic of memory, or more exactly, the art of memory retention and retrieval. In antiquity, unlike today, memory was not just a passive receptacle. For the Greeks and Romans, memory was a tool, a weapon even. It was intricately entwined with the whole thinking process. These ancient peoples had to think on their feet. To do that effectively, they needed a perfectly honed memory. And the years at the rhetor's school provided Roman boys with just the tool needed to achieve that end. Today, the technique is known as mnemotechnics, and it is very, very powerful. Seneca's father, in the preface to his book on controversiae, gives us an insight into just what could be achieved by perfecting the technique. These are his own words. When 2,000 names had been reeled off, I would repeat them in the same order. And when my assembled schoolfellows each supplied a line of poetry up to the number of more than 200, I would recite them in reverse. In the same preface, the elder Seneca wrote the following about his closest friend, one Porcius Latro, who was a well-known declaimer. His memory, wrote Seneca, was naturally good and much improved by technique. He would never read over again what he was going to say in order to learn it off. He had learnt it off as he wrote, which is the more remarkable because he used to write not slowly and painstakingly, but with almost the same impetuosity as marked his speech. Not only had nature blessed Latro with a fine memory, but he had supreme technique for grasping and for retaining what he had to remember, so that he could recall all the declamations he had ever spoken. He had thus made books superfluous. He used to say he wrote in his mind. What he had mentally rehearsed, he used to speak without his memory ever falling in a single word. He had vast knowledge of the whole range of history. He would ask someone to name a general to him and then immediately detail his feats with fluency. So true was it that he had at his fingertips whatever had once come his way. The elder Seneca then goes on to give a tantalizing teaser about this extraordinary technique. Directly addressing his three sons to whom he had dedicated the volume, he says, "I can see, my dear young men, that you are more astonished by this talent of Latro than you should be. I want you to admire other qualities in him. This one, which you make so much of, can be acquired by a technique that requires little trouble. Within the small space of a very few days, anyone can do what Cineas did. This man, sent as ambassador to Rome by Pyrrhus, next day, as a newcomer, greeted by their correct names the Senate and the whole crowd of townspeople around the Senate. Or he can emulate the man who, hearing a new poem recited by its author, said it was his own, and proceeded to recite it from memory even though its author could not do the same. Or Hortensius, who, challenged by Cicena, sat all day at an auction, and enlisted without a mistake and in the right order all the articles, their prices and purchases, with the bankers authenticating the details. You want to learn straight away? I will keep your eagerness in suspense and leave myself room to do you a second service. Meanwhile, I shall discharge my present debt to you." Unfortunately for us in the modern age, the elder Seneca never does, at least not in his books that have survived. There are, however, some details in other sources. This podcast doesn't really have time to list everything written about the science of mnemotechnics. So if any listener wants further information on this fascinating subject, please feel free to contact me through the website and I'll supply the most relevant resources. For now, though, I'll describe the basics. The teenage Seneca would have been taught to create a framework in his mind within which he could construct compartments for storing information in bite-sized chunks. Each compartment would be easily identified by a trigger, a mental symbol, a word, an object, something like that, that had an unusual characteristic. The easy visibility of these triggers in Seneca's mind's eye would enable him to navigate easily and swiftly to the information required, and his trigger sequence would tell him what other information surrounded that to which he had just navigated. As each framework became full or was no longer needed, so the same structure could be used for each different subject, or its content could be erased and newer information stored in its place. Let's take the small example of committing objects to memory. I wish to remember 14 different items, so I allocate 3 of my mental triggers to mark compartments containing 5 pieces of information each. The total number of objects, 14, and the first 4 subjects, or objects, are placed in a compartment designated by a red flashing figure 1. The figure 1 tells me it is the first compartment in the sequence, and the flashing red makes it unusual enough for my long-term memory to hold on to it. Objects 5 to 9 I store in a compartment designated by a golden hand. The hand symbol reminds me that we are onto the 5th object, and the hand's golden colour sets it apart for easier memory recall. In the 3rd compartment, I place objects 10 to 14. This compartment is designated by the trigger of my friend Decius, which is the Latin for 10th, and it's also a common man's name, who is dressed as a woman. The name Decius tells me that we are onto the 10th object, and his unusual garb ensures my memory will easily find the image. This is a simplified version of the technique. There were other methods for compartmentalizing information, such as visualizing a house for the major framework. Individual rooms within that house were used as triggers, and paintings and mosaics, with which Roman walls were generally absolutely smothered, or items of furniture within each room for the individual pieces of information. The idea behind this method was that the framework employed for information storage was already etched into the trainee's mind. Seneca's father was a man of the old school. When he wrote his books on rhetoric, he was already bemoaning the effeminate hair-braiding ways of some contemporary Roman youth. Perhaps it was this that had prompted him to bring the younger Seneca under his personal guidance at such an early age. In any event, we can be sure that he would make certain his son excelled at school, especially in those subjects about which he had written his own books. Apart from the one jibe at his Grammaticus, the younger Seneca tells us almost nothing about his school days, so we have to imagine them for ourselves. I see him as an assiduous student, excelling at the exercises of the suasoria and controversia. He was a sickly child, something I will speak more on in the next podcast, so I envision him as a boy forced to dedicate himself more to his books and forego the rough and tumble of adolescent play. He became adept at rhetorical techniques such as employing colourful anecdotes and using great Romans of the past as examples. He mastered the use of vivid metaphors and sustained imagery, and he created heated literary exchanges with imaginary interlocutors. All of these things were psychagogic tools. That is, they were designed to elicit a deliberate and particular response on the part of the listener or reader. Seneca was fast becoming a master orator. How assiduously the Roman pupil of a rhetoric school applied himself to his studies, or how far he took them beyond the initial 3 to 4 years of training, were directly commensurate with his ambitions towards public office. But here is where we'll have to leave Lucius Annaeus Seneca for now, a teenager of no more than 16 years of age. He has completed his standard education under the rhetors and must embark upon the next stage of his life. Although there is no record of Seneca's ever having travelled to Greece, as many Romans did, to further his education under the philosophers or rhetors based in that country, he certainly did seek them out in Rome itself. What Seneca did next was going to land him in some very hot water.